allergies. 1 in 10 kids have a food allergy. 1 in 5 have an environmental allergy of some kind. And today we unpack that with one of the world's top pediatricians here on the Low Tox Life podcast. And welcome to the Low Tox Life podcast. I'm Alex Stewart, your host and the founder of the Low Tox Movement, and I could not be more thrilled that you have decided to press play and join me today, because my guest is not only a dear friend, she is also one of the smartest dang pediatricians in the world, in my view, and I've met a fair few, and her name is Dr. Alyssa Song. I've wanted to do a show on allergies that was really comprehensive and looked at all of the things plugging into the current epidemic levels of allergies, but also look at allergies as they pertain to immune health, nervous system health, dysregulation of various types of cells, and how we could look at the best kind of testing and screening, the best kind of monitoring. What does SOS look like? What does the long game look like? How do we build resilience and immune flexibility when it comes to exposures as we try to reduce allergic presentations and heal? And of course, the gut is very much involved in that. It is a fantastic nerd out, and I know I usually send you guys out into nature on a walk to listen to the show. It's really, you know what? It's a pen and paper show today. If you or someone you know has an allergy, I would just be so grateful if you pass this on, because it is genuinely an amazing body of work in the next hour and 10 minutes or so as we unpack this topic so comprehensively. And for those of you who haven't come across Dr. Alyssa Song, we did a show a few years ago, show number 85, if you want to look it up, on global childhood epidemics. And we've been friends for years. I had her whole family over to our house once when they were visiting from Australia, and we've done the Bondi to Bronte walk, which is my standard friends from overseas show and tell of this beautiful city that I get to live in. And she is Stanford trained. I could tell you all the technical stuff. She's got a fantastic book coming out that is far more important, though. Healthy Kids, Happy Kids is her body of work and offering to parents all over the world. She obviously can't consult with everybody. And it is a brilliant book. The Aussies are going to have to wait till September, although pre-orders will open up shortly. You lucky, lucky people in the Northern Hemisphere over in America, Canada, you get to pre-order it right now if you're listening live this week, and it's coming out May 14, just around the corner. I have all the details in the show notes for you. You can always head to lowtoxlife.com/podcast to check out not only the details of the show today and an overview of all the questions I asked and ways that you can connect with Alyssa's work or any show guest if you look back, but also the special offers. These are predominantly for our Aussie listeners, but we do every now and then have an international one, and they're to help you with your low-tox swaps. Many of you would have heard of the brand Weleda, and so if it's time for you to replenish a few of your favorites or maybe try some low-tox, high-performance and low-cost skincare and healthcare products for your family for the first time, we have 20% off with the code LOWTOXLIFE. April 29 through to June 30, 2024. So that is a huge help towards making your low tox swaps. And if things are a bit tight right now, it's a great time to stock up. I know I will be lathering myself in all things firming pomegranate. as I work to maintain and promote skin elasticity in the midlife flux. But there are just so many things. And actually, someone who worked on my team for many years, the gorgeous Steph, naturopath, has just had a little bubba, and I cannot wait to deliver her my usual food care package and, of course, some Weleda calendula products, just as I used on my boy Seb when he was a bub. We still have our major sponsor all year through. You can get 10% off with the code LOTOXLIFE on all dehumidifiers and Winix air purifiers from Oz Climate. So your code there is LOTOXLIFE. You can also call them if you have a floor plan that you're just like, oh, I don't know what size to get. I don't know what we need. They can talk you through your climate, your floor space, and make the best recommendation. But to give you an idea of what we have, I have two compact four-stage air purifiers in each of our, one in each of our bedrooms. And then we have the five-stage in our living dining areas. And we have a 50-liter dehumidifier that we run through the larger rooms in the house when it's raining or when it's a really humid season. And we have the little compact 16-liter dehumidifier that we run between the bathroom and the laundry. That works great for a two-bedroom apartment situation. And then if you wanted to just extrapolate from there, go for it. So ozclimate.com.au for that offer. And, of course, weleda.com.au for the huge 20% off you have now through the whole month of May. Enjoy and let us now unpack the monster topic of allergies and create some empowerment. There is no way you're going to get to the end of this conversation without feeling like you have some proactive steps forward. I know I certainly did myself. Enjoy.
Hello, Elisa. How are you?
Oh, I'm so good, Alex. I love chatting with you. I love seeing you. And I'm so so honored to be back on again.
It is so exciting. And I know we kind of just pretend hello, but we've been like talking for half an hour because we hadn't for a while. And I think when we did our first show and the beautiful friendship we've had since, we were really opening up the Pandora's box of modern childhood epidemics. And we touched on, obviously, each of them. But I wanted to unpack one today, which the numbers just keep creeping up, and it's on allergy. So I was looking as I was preparing for today's chat, and we are up to nearly 10% of people, kids, with a food allergy, and nearly 20%. And when you just single out boys, it is 20%, if you look at the CDC, on environmental allergies, so dust mite, grass, mold, etc. Oh my gosh. And so obviously there's a correlation between like rising pollution, rising processed food, decreasing gut bugs and gut health. And today you are here to help us unpack like some of the big questions around what can we do? Am I stuck with this forever? Am I going to have to be panicking about peanuts when my kid's backpacking when he's 19? Like, you know, like they're big, stressful questions, and more stressful the more intense and severe the presentation. It can really be quite anxiety ridden, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, allergies are, it's just, you know, even in my career as a pediatrician, I mean, I look back to when I was in medical school. Now this was in the late 1990s. And I mean, sure, there was kind of the one-off of a child who might need an EpiPen, but I mean, fast forward, oh my gosh. I mean, you know, EpiPens are sort of, you know, when I look in my daughter's classrooms and, you know, going on field trips and being one of the chaperones. I mean, so many kids have EpiPens that they're carrying, and, you know, it's the anaphylactic food allergies, but it's also the less, you know, less severe, but still, you know, severe food allergies and the environmental allergies. It's just, it's, you know, mounting at such an increasing rate. And, you know, the number of kids now who from, it seems almost from the moment they're born, you know, with cow's milk allergies or egg allergies that break out into eczema when their moms even just have a tiny little bit, you know, while they're nursing. And so, you know, we need to recognize that there is this shift in the way our children's, our infants and our children's immune systems are developing. and shaping that is informing their later risk of allergies of all sorts, whether they develop when they're infants or sometimes they show up years later, but it really starts in that early infancy for most of us, you know, for most babies.
Yeah. And so what are we looking at here? What are the components that feed into this rising picture in your view? Like I shared some of the correlations you could point out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are they causations as well?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think the number one thing that we need to look at is how our babies' microbiomes develop. You know, our infant microbiome, we know that the infant microbiome now is so key to the future health potential of this child in front of you, this adolescent that they're going to become, the adult that they're going to become, in terms of their immune health, their brain and mental health, their metabolic health, their hormone health. All of that really gets sort of imprinted by those first 1,000 days, you know, where the microbiome is taking shape, really from, you know, preconception with mama's microbiome, vaginal and breast microbiomes and gut microbiomes. But from the moment that baby is born until the first 2.5 to 3 years of age, we have this critical window where the microbiome is communicating and housing 80% of your baby's immune system and informing their blood's immune system how to behave. Are they going to develop, quote, tolerance to these different foods or environmental allergens that are coming their way? Or are they going to develop an inflammatory allergic response? And, you know, one of the things that, you know, through just digging in through what's going on with their kids' microbiomes, what's really interesting is that our kids' microbiomes, the composition has changed through the decades, through the centuries. And, you know, there was a Scottish pathologist who, you know, had the wherewithal to test microbiomes of infants 100 years ago. And compared the microbiomes of babies who were breastfed at the time and babies who received formula at the time. And yes, you know, there were some babies who did need formula even a century ago. And what he found was that the babies who were breastfed had nearly 100% bifidobacteria in their gut microbiomes, nearly 100%, whereas the microbiomes of the formula fed babies had many other bacteria that were in those initial stages. We know bifidobacteria is really important for that tolerance, for building immune tolerance to foods and to environmental allergens.
They're the calm the farm kind of bacteria, right, as well. If you think about the antihistamine style probiotic formulas like that Ben Lynch has, or, you know, I know that those bifidos, and I remember when I had mold illness and I did an advanced stool sample, the bifidos were very scarce.
Yeah.
And I had tons of lactose. So
that's right. And you know, as we get older, we have less bifido relative to other. We get more lacto and we get other species. But even for adults, as you noted, right, as you're going through your mycotoxin illness, bifido is so important for our immune response. And, you know, even during COVID, there was a microbiologist, Dr. Sabine Hazan, in Southern California, right? And she found that you could correlate the adults who seem to have higher risks, you know, worse COVID outcomes, you could see that they had less bifidobacter in their microbiomes. And so fast forward now, you know, to nearly 100 years to our current infants' microbiomes, and even the breastfed baby of today has a gut microbiome that is much more similar to the formula-fed baby of 100 years ago because of that loss of bifidobacteria. And bifidobacteria, they are the species in our microbiome that feed on human milk oligosaccharides, these very special prebiotics that are found only in human breast milk, although now there are synthetic forms that are being put into infant formulas and into some infant probiotic blends and can be bought, can be purchased individually, that are you know, great benefits even for adults. Via the vagus nerve, right? There's this communication. Bifido loves to communicate with your brain via the vagus nerve. Bifido, our bifido species, love to bring their friends along with them. So, you know, there's a type of bacteria called F. Prau, Faecalibacterium prausnitzii, which is responsible one of our butyrate producing microbes. So Bifidor helps our butyrate producing buddies in our gut to flourish. And butyrate is now considered one of our master regulators of health. So you can see how just from this bifido, we can have this immune tolerance, this calm brain phenomena, this production of this short chain fatty acid, you know, butyrate that helps then to regulate our metabolism, our immune health, our brain health. So I think that, you know, if we can really think about, well, we see this disruption to our children's microbiomes, even for babies who are vaginally birthed and breastfed. And so we have to think, well, what's going on? Why are our children's microbiomes different? And if we can get to the crux of that, I think then we can really help to restore balance to our children's microbiomes so that we don't see the downstream effects when they're older of allergic diseases. I mean, when we're talking about allergies, we know disruption plays a big role. And there was a study, a very large study, a military study that looked at nearly 800,000 infants. And they looked at infants who received antibiotics or antacid medications within the first 6 months of life, and found that those infants had a significantly increased risk, sometimes double the risk, of virtually every single allergic disease by the time they were 4 years of age. And that includes anaphylactic food allergies, hay fever, hives, eczema, asthma, even autoimmunity later on. And so, you know, doing everything we can to maintain microbiome resilience in our infants, in our children, in our teens, and in us as adults is going to really be one of the most impactful, especially when we're talking about allergic diseases.
Mm. And so let's just say someone out there is listening, they've got a baby next week, baby really sick, antibiotics, really, really the only option. And of course, this is where we are very grateful for them. Now, what can that mum or dad do in the having to take of the course of the antibiotics to support the prevention, I guess, of the depletion of the microbiome?
Yeah, so many things. So I love that question because first we have to recognize that especially in children, some studies have found that up to 70% of antibiotics are inappropriately prescribed. So for things like viral infections where they're not going to do anything, right?
So can I just say then in that, should we be demanding swab testing every time antibiotics are put on the table in this day and age?
So I think that we should be asking questions. Right.
Okay. Demanding with too harsh a word. Yes.
But in some cases, there are swabs available, like for strep throat, 100%. You know, if your child has a sore throat, and even if you look and it's a raging red sore throat with pus on the tonsils and it looks like strep, I would demand a swab in that case. I would demand proof from a rapid test and a culture. A throat culture to show that it actually is strep, because viral pharyngitis, like let's say the monovirus Epstein-Barr, can look exactly like strep throat. And there is zero way a clinician can look at your child's throat or your throat if it's the same situation and say, I know it's strep. There's just no way. I don't care how long you've been a doctor. You cannot look and tell it's strep. Now, there might be some clinical clues. You know, if it's strep throat, usually there's not really any other respiratory symptoms. You usually don't get a runny nose or a cough or other things, as opposed to a viral pharyngitis. They often do go along with other respiratory symptoms, but it doesn't matter. The look of it doesn't matter. It can be the most severe, awful looking sore throat, and it could still be viral. In fact, some of the worst sore throats I've seen are viral, not strep throat, right? So yes, I would demand, you know, a swab for that. Now, something like an ear infection, you can't really swab. Although, you know, if your child has a ruptured eardrum and there's some material, some pus coming out, yes, I would swab that, right? Because we know that most ear infections are kind of mixed. They can have virus and bacteria. Sometimes I've had fungus grow out from ear canals, right? Which then, of course, fungus don't respond to antibiotics. Viruses don't respond to antibiotics. And even most bacterial ear infections will resolve without antibiotics. So I actually have a list of 6 questions in my book to ask the doctor before you start antibiotics. And the number
Love
one question,
that.
Right?
Yes.
Because, you know, we don't want to, you know, we don't, as you said, sometimes they're absolutely necessary. And I tell everybody, both of my children received antibiotics when they were under 2 months of age. And my Kenzie had a urinary tract infection when she was 2 weeks of age. Bodhi did have strep with pus coming out of his ear, right? And I cultured that. So, and that was at 5 weeks of age. So, and we're going to get to like, how do you restore your child's microbiome? But they were absolutely necessary. So sometimes they are. But the number one question to ask the prescribing physician, you have to ask, hey, doc, is this antibiotic really necessary? I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but that some studies have found that, you know, like doctors are twice as likely to prescribe an antibiotic, even if they don't think it's going to be helpful, if they think that the patient wants a prescription. Right. So if you simply just ask the question, you know, hey, is it really necessary? It lets the doctor know that you're not one of the moms coming in that just wants to, you know, come in and leave out the door with a prescription in hand, that, you know,
to feel like you've done something.
That's right. You'll use it if it's necessary, but you want to be judicious about it. Right. And so you just, you know, you have to ask the questions. It's very, very important, because we want to use them when they're necessary, but we also don't want to overuse them, because in this overuse, it's your child's microbiome, you know, that's being disrupted, or yours if you're on antibiotics. It's also a public health concern. Right. Because, you know, by 2050, there's some estimates that antibiotic resistance is going to become a leading cause of death. And that is frightening. I mean, antibiotics have been one of, you know, the most profound, public health inventions of the 20th century. And now fast forward to the 21st century. Could you imagine if a simple skin infection was something that could do you in, right? And so, you know, we just need to be good antibiotic stewards and understand that they can be necessary. Many times they're not. And then, you know, when they are necessary, how do we maintain your microbiome, right? So that's really key.
It is key. So can we get some good ideas
that? Absolutely.
Because I know everyone will be like, so tell me what I need to do.
Yeah. And so, you know, for parents listening, the same thing can hold true. Like, even if, like, let's say, you know, for Bodhi, he had antibiotics when he was 5 weeks of age, and I didn't know that, you know, that restoration of the microbiome was really important. And now he's 12 and, you know, maybe, you know, knock on wood, he's healthy. But let's say, for instance, he had eczema, or he had allergies, or maybe some ADHD attention focus issues stemming because of the intimate gut brain connection and the disruption that happened there, right? You can still recover your child's microbiome. So we can do all these steps even many years down the road. It might take a little longer to recover, but you know, all hope's not lost, right? We just have to know, though. The first step is knowing, oh, okay, if my child has behavioral concerns or they have skin concerns or whatever it is, we want to look at the microbiome. So ideally, if you are starting antibiotics, you would start a probiotic and a prebiotic supplement alongside the antibiotic. So start with the course. There are all sorts of fallacies, you know, these myths going around. I've had parents go to the ER and call me and ask me, oh, you know, the ER doc said, you know, I shouldn't take a probiotic while my child's on an antibiotic because it will make the antibiotic not work.
Oh,
as well.
Like, yeah, no.
Like, no, that doesn't work.
We're done with that.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, it is true, though, that antibiotics, because they're not, you know, specific about what they kill, which is why they can kill all the good bacteria in your gut microbiome, we want to take the probiotics at a different time of day than the antibiotic, just so that you're not taking the antibiotic right after your probiotic, and then it goes right in there and it kills the probiotics too, right?
Mm. Yeah, you got to think about it like a binder, right? You would take it away from other medicines. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Now, you know, what probiotics? Well, that's a million-dollar question, right? Because, you know, I used to say, and this is probably one of the biggest shifts in my practice, I used to say, you know, yeah, most people would benefit from taking a probiotic every single day. Well, not necessarily anymore, right? Because there are thousands and thousands of different strains that are being identified, each with a different benefit. And not all probiotic strains are really that good at restoring your microbiome. Some of them may be really good at creating like serotonin and dopamine for you. Some of them might be really good for your skin or for your vaginal flora, right? So, you know, we want to really think about the different strains that we're using, but, you know, we're not quite there yet in terms of really getting amazing, you know, strain specific combinations. I think, you know, that's where the future is going to head. So for now, you choose a broad spectrum probiotic. You know, you can use, you know, what does broad spectrum mean? A variety of different bifidobacteria species, lactobacillus species. You can choose, you can also add in Saccharomyces boulardii, which is actually a yeast probiotic, not a bacterial one.
One of my faves. Love that one.
Saccharomyces boulardii can actually enhance your immune capacity in your gut. It improves something called secretory IgA antibody in your gut. It also has been shown to reduce antibiotic-induced diarrhea, so also another very common side effect, right? And now there are, you know, more and more availability of these spore-based, you know, bacillus, coagulans and Clausii that are available as well. There's not, I'm going to be totally honest, I think spores are great. There's not great research in children with spores.
Okay.
Right? So
spore-based probiotics could just be a little faddish to jump on the bandwagon at this point when you look at the research.
At this point, there's not. I mean, there's one bacillus Clausii strain out of India that's been well studied in infants. It's not as commercially available. So the spore-based strain, you know, there are some studies in adults that are promising. But, you know, we know kids' microbiomes are not the same as adult microbiomes, and they don't respond necessarily the same as adult microbiomes. So I have used some spores in kids, but I've reserved sort of blanketly saying, oh, every child should be on a spore-based probiotic now. But, you know, so we start the probiotic alongside. We want to make sure, though, that we understand that just throwing in trillions or, you know, let's say billions of you know, colonies into your gut, kind of throwing them down there, doesn't necessarily make them stick.
More is more is not true. Yeah.
It is not true. More is not always better. That's a very Western thing, right? You know, that, you know, oh, you need more. Well, let's, instead of, you know, 25 billion, why don't we throw like 450 billion at it, or maybe 900. So more isn't always better, right? Because there are some studies showing that if we throw in a ton of different probiotics into your gut microbiome, it can sometimes crowd out the return of your native flora, the flora that wants to be in your microbiome. All of us have a different microbiome. So when we ask the question, what's the perfect microbiome? We have to ask, well, for whom, right? Because it'll vary depending on your sex, your age, your race and ethnicity. And so, you know, there's not one perfect microbiome. I mean, even when we're thinking about fecal transplants, that's the problem with it, right? I mean, it's like, well, how are you matching the person who's, you know, basically donating their poop, you know, because it's got to be specific for you. I mean, the idea, I've spoken with some microbiologists who think before antibiotics or before surgery or before anything that we know can immediately disrupt the microbiome, the ideal thing would be to take your own poop sample, right? Cultivate that. And then when you, after the surgery, or when you take the antibiotics, you re-inoculate with your own flora. That's called an autologous fecal microbiome transplant, right?
That is now, fabulously nerdy. It's
fabulous.
I love that.
But we're not there yet, right? Mm. And then the question is also, did you have the healthiest microbiome to begin with, right? I mean, if you have ADHD or autoimmunity or something like that, or if you have metabolic syndrome, diabetes, maybe there's some optimization that can happen. But anyhow, it's not just about throwing more. It's also about creating an ecosystem, an environment in your microbiome where these beneficial bacteria, yeast, even beneficial viruses want to come back and create a community again, right? They want to come back and call your gut their home. And so that's where you can pair prebiotics with the probiotic so that you have the food to fuel the probiotics and help them thrive. But even beyond that, this is the time to double down on all of the nourishing factors for your gut microbiome, because we want this place to be, I mean, like the best neighborhood that these microbes could want to move into, right? And so that means, you know, when we're thinking about all the things that nourish your microbiome, it has to include fiber from real fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes, you know, if you can tolerate them. It has to include all the colorful phytonutrients that act as prebiotics and also interact with your microbial genes to modify our genes, right? Fermented foods were found in one study to restore microbial diversity and composition better than fiber. Whereas fiber was really helpful for microbiome functioning. So production of, you know, short chain fatty acids like butyrate. So we get in all the things that nourish your microbiome. And it's really equally important that, you know, when we're trying to rebuild, it's sort of like, you know, after a forest fire, right? Imagine your gut microbiome has just been raised, you know, by these antibiotics. And so if we're trying to rebuild the forest, I mean, how do we do that? We don't just throw sapling seeds on the ground, right? We're throwing in.
You prepare the soil
and the sunlight and the water. And we try to keep away, you know, chemicals and, you know, pests that are going to really eat away, you know, at the forest that we're trying to cultivate. So we want to keep away all of the factors in our modern world that are acting to every single day disrupt our microbiome and can literally directly trigger leaky gut and zonulin release, preferentially preserve, you know, the bad bacteria relative to the beneficial flora. And so that means you gotta get out, you know, the artificial food dyes, the food additives, especially food emulsifiers that are found in a lot of packaged foods that can disrupt the gut microbiome. You know, we want to really watch all the added sugars and, you know, glyphosate, you know, herbicides that are used, pesticides, many of them. Glyphosate was initially patented as an antibiotic. And so, you know, we want to make sure let's eat as organically as possible. Let's cultivate this resilience in our microbiome. And so, you know, doing all of those things at that time will help to restore your child's microbiome and also help it to stay there. Right. Because, you know, you could, for instance, take a probiotic supplement, a prebiotic supplement. We want to make sure some antibiotics will directly trigger leaky gut as well. So you could, you know, think about taking an extra omega-3, you know, fish oil supplement, zinc, glutamine to make sure the intestinal lining stays really intact. But when you stop that after a month or two, okay, your microbiome is restored. But if you go back to all the ways of, you know, maybe, you know, eating out of packaged foods, stress, you know, busy, not getting enough sleep, not moving your bodies, your microbiome is going to slowly shift back to a state that's less resilient so that with the next round of antibiotics or next big stressor, it's going to fall apart again, right? So we want that solid. We want, like, you know, the California redwoods that can withstand any fire, right?
So I love the metaphor of, like, you are trying to create the best neighborhood that they would just want to move into and set up house. I think those visuals really help you get in touch with the deeper work and feel a sense of purpose around the change, especially if it's a big shift for your family, which it often is. You know, sadly, we often have those critical moments or the big allergy episode, and then boom, that's when you wake up and something has to change.
Yeah.
So,
or you get
scary.
Ear infection after ear infection, and you're like, okay, you're on this kind of cycle. And so that can be the impetus for change. So, and it doesn't have to be all at once, but, you know, it's just really being aware of, okay, knowing now how important my child's microbiome is to their overall, you know, health and resilience. How are we going to educate our kids, first of all, so that they want to nourish their little buddies too? I mean, they need to really consider their microbiome as their best friends, their best allies, right? And, you know, really create a culture in our home that supports living in a way that just naturally supports our microbiome. We don't have to think about it, but all the different ways that we can live is, you know, if it's done in a kind of a microbiome centric way, it's that the magic in your microbiome is going to happen, right? We don't have to think consciously about it.
Yes. And it's about, like, really thinking of the stuff you do at home, like good bookends that kind of create the structure. And it doesn't matter if a book falls off the shelf every now and then, pick it back up, put it back in. But if you've got the structure there, we're going to the park in our free time, we're going to the beach, getting a swim in, taking a forest hike, like all that nature stuff, all the no blue lights, you know, come on, off the phones, off the iPads, off the TV, go read a book in bed with your red light and get sleepy. These things are, you know, if you've got those in place and most meals are from scratch, then the little hiccups are less likely to impact us in big
Absolutely.
Ways.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we think about it, because for a lot of us, right, I mean, think about us as parents. It's so much easier to do things for our children than it is to practice self-care for ourselves, right?
Hello, yeah.
And so, right? And so, you know, if we talk to our kids about these trillions of tiny little friends in our microenvironment, how much they take care of us and how much they rely on us to take care of them, it gives a different perspective on, you know, how we're eating and how we're living, because all of that impacts. I mean, I talk to kids about, you know, Finding Nemo, that clownfish and that anemone, they need each other, right? I mean, that's just like you and your microbes in your gut. And so the fascinating thing about, you know, walking in nature, engaging your vagus nerve, getting a restorative sleep, exercising, all of those have been found in the literature to improve your gut microbiome. And all of these, like, let's say, you know, improving heart rate variability and vagus nerve functioning through breath work or through laughing together or through gratitude. So anything that improves your vagus nerve output and your heart rate variability will actually directly improve your gut microbiome diversity and functioning, independent of diet. Because
wow,
I know, you know,
that's
right?
Huge.
It's huge, because diet for parents, I mean, especially, you know,
it's
in our world,
such a focus. Yeah.
Yes. And it can be one of the most stressful things to change, especially if that's not yet your family culture, or, you know, your kids are like our kids are older and they're at school and they're seeing all of their friends with the package X, Y, and Z. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough to, you know, really think about changing diet. Or if your kids are really, really selective and you're like, I don't know, they're not eating a single vegetable right now. And, you know, now you want me to eat a rainbow. I'm like, okay, well then let's not do that first.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's work on breath work, or let's move our bodies. Let's have fun together, you know, because all of that will make a difference.
I love that you just said, let's have fun together. Cause I genuinely think when it's the health conversation, we forget the fun part, the joy part. And it's such a huge part of having a healthy vagus nerve, a healthy gut brain connection, feeling a sense of lightness and joy. Like, not everything has to be this serious undertaking for our health because you've got a big allergy. And we can very easily be caught up in the stress of that situation. I get it.
Yeah. Well, and then we just have to remember too, I mean, I let kids know that, like, you know, when you measure your inflammatory cytokines and certain levels of different, you know, stress hormones, psychological stress sometimes has a bigger impact on that than infections or toxins or, you know, any physiologic stress. And so, you know, it's not to paint all stress in a bad light, because we need a certain stress is just your physical response. But if it's prolonged and unmanageable and just chronic,
and not flexible, like
not
you can't
flexible.
Dip back into relaxation easily.
Yeah. I mean, that can be way more inflammatory than the actual problem that you're trying to deal with, right? And so, you know, learning how to have that flexibility, have that balance is so important when we're trying to recover from a health concern or just move towards a different state of health.
So important. And can I just paint a picture of the current situation a lot of families are in? And I've actually experienced it myself with my son when it comes to an allergy diagnostic process and then what the future looks like for that.
Yes.
Because if you, like, I remember we were eating a hippie piece of toast that I had made, I had brought because I wanted a grain-free option when we were staying with friends. And it had like a few different kind of berries and things in it. It was really dense and delicious. But Seb breaks out in a huge rash, big blotchy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's never had this. Mom, my hands are stinging. I can't touch them. They're too hot. And I was like, Jesus, what? Okay. So go to doctor, get the referral to the allergist. A $500 appointment gets you the skin pricks, bring the piece of toast he had the issue with, and we'll test the different ingredients. And we get he gets diagnosed with an inca berry allergy. I mean, we only live 5 kilometers from Bondi. It feels like the ultimate hippie Bondi allergy to be diagnosed with. And so I was like, okay. And then we get given his allergy plan that gets shared with the school, and we get told, come back in 2 years and we'll test it again. My husband happened to be the one who could take the appointment the second time round. Now, luckily, inca berry is very easy to avoid. It's pretty rare. And my husband calls me, goes, did we just pay $500 for a nurse to prick his skin and tell us, yep, it's still the same as last time. We'll see you again in 2 years. And I was like, yeah, I believe we did. And I just think that's insane as a framework for dealing with an allergy. So I would love to spend our last 15 minutes unpacking the futility of that merry-go-round, the, oh, well, this is how it is, and how it would be better to step through an allergy experience I feel like the things we've been talking about already, of course, play into what we could be doing differently. But like in our case, where we are hitting a lot of those markers, is there some secret sauce? Is there some extra stuff we could do?
So when we think about allergies, I mean, and in this case, we're thinking about allergies that are mediated by an antibody called IgE.
I would love to unpack those differences. Yeah.
So that's important to distinguish, because we have this IgE part of our immune system that really is involved in immediate allergic reactions. And these are allergic reactions, like with SEB, typically happen within seconds of eating a food to maybe an hour. So they're typically fairly obvious. They can be skin, like hives. Sometimes it's more itchy tongue, swollen tongue or lips. They can manifest as GI symptoms with immediate vomiting, like your body's literally trying to purge it out, or become the more serious respiratory anaphylactic reactions as well. What's fascinating about the allergic reactions, the IgE reactions that are on the skin, like the hives, they look really dramatic. But thankfully, those typically don't progress on to be the anaphylactic type allergies. If you have, though, the internal, the tongue swelling, the vomiting, you know, the respiratory, then that, you know, that is, you know, a more serious, where you probably do want to make sure that, you know, depending on what the allergen is, as you said, inca berry is easy to avoid, but you know, avoiding peanuts or soy might be much more challenging, right? And so, you know, having an EpiPen and having that allergy action plan at school can be really important. Now, it's many IgE allergies, I shouldn't say that. You know, it used to be that if we thought about these anaphylactic or IgE food allergies, they were ones that, you know, kids were born with or presented early on in life with their first exposure to the food. Interestingly, I'm finding a lot more and more kids who are developing these IgE allergies later on in life. Or you get the story of these teenagers or these college kids where they've never been allergic to shellfish. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, they're having this, you know, huge allergic reaction, right? So, and that I do think is as their microbiomes and immune systems are changing, they're not responding appropriately to these foods that they've eaten tons of times before, right? So we have these. Now there's also the IgG, immunoglobulin type G, arm of our immune system that is more involved in these what are called delayed hypersensitivity reactions. So they are, quote, allergies in a sense, but these reactions can happen sometimes within hours, but sometimes it can take 3 or 4 days for a reaction to occur. Mm-hmm. And these non-IgE mediated IgG reactions can manifest pretty much anywhere in our body. So they can be joint pains, they can be mood, behavior issues, they can be brain fog, they can be GI, like tummy issues and, you know, sometimes constipation, sometimes diarrhea, sometimes eczema. Like eczema can often be associated with that. Now, these IgG reactions are a sign of a leaky gut. They're a sign that your intestines have lost, the intestinal lining has lost its integrity. And so they're allowing these food antigens that, you're eating, you know, probably every day to get into your bloodstream. And eventually your immune system can't clear them away. And they start developing these IgG reactions to them. Now, the good thing about IgG allergies, these delayed reactions, are that they typically, if we can go through an elimination diet, a gut reset by sealing and healing the leaky gut, eliminating, you know, any organisms, dysbiotic organisms that shouldn't be there, many of these can resolve, right? The IgE allergies, sometimes they can resolve, but we're a lot more cautious because once you've developed them, it's a lot harder, you know, to get rid of. Now, for some of the anaphylactic food allergies, we're really fortunate now that out of Stanford and Duke University, there's been a lot of research around oral desensitization. So these allergy drops where you can be desensitized to even the most severe anaphylactic, you know, cashew allergy, which is so great because as a parent and as a child growing up with a life-threatening allergy, it does, you know, make you oftentimes have a different relationship with food and the fear around.
It's very hard to keep it healthy and relaxed when you're terrified of an exposure.
So I feel like that desensitization can really help, you know, people breathe a little bit more easily. Now, here's the thing, though. I think that a lot of the allergies that do develop a little bit later on, because the IgE allergies are more histamine mediated, and you know, typically, I mean, there are many different kinds of cells that can release histamine, but there are mast cells and there are basophils. If we can work on restoring the gut microbiome, making sure there's plenty of bifidobacteria around, and also stabilizing the mast cells, stabilizing that overactive immune response. I have seen kids where these lesser IgE allergies on testing, those go away, right? Sometimes, you know, the larger, like the big peanut one or the big soy one, that, you know, that may stay, but it might get a little bit lower on the scratch testing or on blood testing. I actually prefer to do blood testing because with blood testing, you can test many, many, many different kinds of foods or environmental allergens. And you can also see there's a number score. So you might see, oh my gosh, dust mites are through the roof. And maybe we target those first, you know, with our dust mite control measures, right? But the more things we can do to stabilize histamine responses, the more likely we are to support a healthier response the next time that allergen is faced, right? Because if you think about it, if we can stabilize mast cells so that, you know, let's say if you're allergic to, you know, macadamia nuts and, you know, a piece of macadamia antigen attaches to your mast cell instead of exploding, you know, with, you know, this huge release of histamine, if the mast cells are stabilized, then that macadamia attaches. Sure, there's a little histamine release, but it's more contained and more controlled. So that's what we want. And there are lots of different supplements that can do that. There's quercetin, there's luteolin, vitamin C and zinc can reduce histamine level, stabilize mast cells. There are certain probiotics, like you mentioned, Ben Lynch's, he's got a probiota histamine X that, you know, can help to degrade some of the histamine and not include some of the histamine producing probiotics strains. And also DAO, so diamine oxidase enzymes, are great if you have food related histamine reactions. Because sometimes when we're allergic to something and our histamine is just floating around like crazy, we start reacting just randomly, maybe not even just to the macadamia nut, but like, well, I don't know, there's no macadamia nuts in here, but all of a sudden I'm really uncomfortable, right? And so it just depends on the histamine load. So sometimes a DAO enzyme, which can break down histamine in your gut, can help you tolerate a lot more foods too with less discomfort.
So what I'm hearing is reminding me of what we were saying about stress, in that you want stress flexibility. It's not that you want no stress. And it kind of feels like what you're saying is we want mast cell flexibility. Like we want them to be able to come to the rescue when we need them, but we don't want them freaking out about every tiny little thing and staying dysregulated.
Yeah. So key, because mast cells should be activated in certain situations. Inflammation should occur in certain situations, but we've kind of, you know, in our minds, many of us have put, you know, mast cells, inflammation, bad, you know, we don't want any inflammation. And that's not true, right? If we never mounted an inflammatory response, we probably wouldn't get over, you know, viruses, and our skin would never heal from a cut, because you need inflammation. We just need a normal amount. And so, yes, we would like a healthy amount, but not an overshoot. And I found, you know, for these overactive immune reactions, whether it's an autoimmune phenomena going on, or, you know, this an IgE or mast cell overload, then there are immune modulating supplements that I love. I love these, you know, specialized pro-resolving mediators from fish oils, but you want to really have a supplement that specifically purifies out these SPMs or PRMs, pro-resolving mediators.
They're incredible. I remember having one of my attacks. I think it was one of the moldy houses or whatever. And I said, Alyssa, what can I do? Double down on your SPMs. And they really did make a huge difference.
I mean, they probably really are my favorite supplement that I think that everyone could benefit from. I don't know if in Australia low-dose naltrexone is available, but compounded low-dose naltrexone can be really, really helpful. Depending on, you know, for some, I don't use a lot of CBD for kids, but I think for some adults that may be and teenagers, it could be appropriate and help also reduce that can help with immune modulation, right? Same immune resilience, immune modulation. That's what we want, that flexibility.
Mm. So we were just obviously talking about that stress flexibility, not only like, you know, relating it back to the nervous system, but also now thinking about mast cell flexibility and inflammatory response flexibility. And given there's so much that traces back to the gut in everything you're talking about, when it comes to testing, we obviously don't just want to, like, you know, go to an allergist and do that whole thing. We've kind of confirmed that that's not always going to produce the kind of data that helps us actually get to the root of what's going on. Is poop testing something like, so, you know, stool testing's become so sophisticated these days, and there are some tests that are really expensive, but is it something you consider super important to do, medium, like, I'd love for you to unpack that subject, because often parents feel pressured to spend like literally their last dime on a $500 test. And that's fine if that's what your kid needs. Any parent will put themselves on the line like that. But let's have a look at the options.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily initially start off with testing. It depends on, I mean, I guess it would really depend on how significant, how severe the symptoms are for a child. If they are, you know, really suffering quite a bit, or let's say they come in with a more, you know, serious chronic health concern, like an autoimmune condition, then I really do want to try to dive into some of the lab work. A stool analysis can be really helpful just because of the intimate connection between your child's gut and their immune system. So when it comes to allergies, food sensitivities, for sure. I mean, we know food sensitivities are a hallmark of, you know, quote, leaky gut. So recognizing some of those imbalances can be helpful, but it's not necessary at first. So, and even for blood testing, and I love doing something called a urine organic acid test. And sometimes it's easier for kids to give urine samples, and it's sometimes they get blood work, or, and for sure, you know, your poop samples can be harder the older kids get and the more they want that privacy. So each of those pieces of information is really helpful. Let's take, you know, blood tests, for instance. There are clinical clues. There are different signs that your child might be telling us that they need more zinc, or they need more magnesium, or they need more vitamin D. So we can go on those clinical clues. When blood testing is helpful is if we're doing some supplementation kind of presumptively on those clinical clues and we're not kind of moving the needle, you know, where as far as we'd like to, and I want to know, well, just how deficient are you? You know, sometimes it's can be shocking how low kids are in their zinc levels and how much needs to be supplemented. The urine organic acid test, for instance, can give us clues as to, are there some other imbalances going on that maybe we're not addressing adequately that we need to support if we're going to get true healing? Like, are there mitochondrial dysfunction issues going on, which is so common in not just adults, but kids too. You know, any kid who has chronic immune stress of any sort, chronic psychological stress, chronic infections going on, chronic toxic exposures, those all stress out your mitochondria. And so we often think, oh, kids have enough energy. Their cellular energy is fine. Kids don't get mitochondrial dysfunction, but we know that's not true. So sometimes that can give a clue. But again, there are clinical clues that your child might have some mitochondrial needs, like if they fatigue more easily than their peers, or they can go, 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 go and be like the fastest runner on the soccer team. But then after the soccer game, or football in Australia, right? After the football game, they can't keep going. Like the rest of their friends are going out for, you know, to have dinner together and a play date and jump on the trampoline. And your kid, they gave it their all. And now they have to go home and lay on the couch for a couple of hours, right? So there can be some signs like that. So my preference initially would be to go with those clinical signs and then also start on some supplements for allergies, for mast cells, for histamine control, modify the diet in, you know, in the way that we can. And then if we get stuck, that's when testing can be more worthwhile. Now, there are some parents who come in and say, I just want to do the tests, right? I just want to know, and I'll do the tests, and then we'll start the supplements. That's great. But as you said, not every parent has access from an affordability standpoint and also a practitioner standpoint to be able to get those tests done.
Yeah, 100%. And so from that, that really struck a chord there when you mentioned the kid who can go, 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 but then they have to lie on the couch for a couple of hours. Because I've often wondered about the legacy impact of water damage on my own son, because he does fatigue more easily than his friends. And so if a parent is noticing that, is that some of the supplements we've already talked about, like the SPMs and that kind of stuff? Or is it more bolstering energy-based supplements like ubiquinol and that kind of family of nutrients?
Yeah, I mean, they would be more kind of mitochondrial support-specific supplements. I mean, the SPMs, in the sense that if there's inflammation that's perpetuating the mitochondrial dysfunction, then SPMs are amazing. But I do give specific mitochondrial support. So, you know, some of the other signs that there might be some mitochondrial issues, I mean, for sure, you know, when there's been exposure to mycotoxins or environmental toxins, we know, I mean, just in the literature, I just did give a talk on endocrine disruptors and kids. And in the research, we find that virtually every environmental toxicant is associated with mitochondrial stress. Chronic infections, you know, whether it's PANS, PANDAS, or chronic Lyme, or, you know, what chronic Epstein-Barr, infections are known to be mitotoxic. I mean, we know the SARS-CoV-2 virus is mitotoxic, which is, you know, why we can see in some people all the hallmarks of chronic fatigue syndrome. You know, is it a reactivation of your Epstein-Barr? I mean, probably in many people, but, you know, then you have the double whammy of this latent Epstein-Barr and then the SARS-CoV-2, both of which stress the mitochondria. So you can have this lower, you know, either just outright lower energy levels or good energy, but easy fatigue, right? We tend to also see lower muscle tone. So maybe they're really strong, you know, from an extremity syndrome, but core muscle tone often tends to be a little weaker. So kids who, you know, just tend to slump a little bit when they're sitting, not because they're on their screens necessarily. I mean, that is a factor.
It's definitely a modern factor.
Yeah. Yeah. But really just because their core muscles are preventing them from being able to keep their core engaged and sit up nice and tall. In younger kids and even older kids, we might see either, some sloppy handwriting because the pencil grip isn't as strong and regulated, or we might see the pressure. Some kids who the pressure of their pen or pencil super light, so very light writing, or it's really hard because they can't regulate the strength that they're having, so they're kind of breaking their pencil points. Another classic sign is the sitting in the W position. So this is where, you sit on the ground on your bottom and, knees are in front of you, but lower legs, your calves and your feet are kind of splayed out to the side of you. So when you look down from up top, it looks like a W. If you have really good muscle tone, that should be really challenging to do, right? You shouldn't have such loose hips and knee joints. So the supplements that I will, another sign can be, if you just have slower recovery from infections, right? So slower recovery from illnesses, because you need your mitochondria and antioxidant reserve to recover quickly, or slower recovery from any like musculoskeletal stress, like, workouts where, you're exercising or you go on a hike and you're like, oh my gosh, my muscles are just cramping and so sore. Could be a magnesium thing, could also be a mitochondrial issue. So the supplements, you mentioned ubiquinol for sure. There's also ribose, D-ribose, which is, it's like a natural sugar that enhances mitochondrial function. That's often paired with carnitine. So L-carnitine, really important for mitochondrial function, which we can see on a urine organic acid test. I'll see elevations.
That's why, right? You love that one.
That's
okay.
Right. So I'll see little elevations in the suberic acid or the adipic acid. I'm like, okay, this kid is having some issues with fatty acid oxidation, not fat, GI absorption and metabolism, but from a cellular standpoint. And then also, with mitochondrial dysfunction, you need a lot of antioxidant support. So you can choose, glutathione, vitamin C, vitamin A or E. I also love, a phospholipid. So there's also some research that phosphatidylcholine and some of your phospholipids can also help support mitochondrial recovery. So, and of course, you don't have to throw the kitchen sink at kids. You can start with a couple of them, and see how they do. I usually start with CoQ10, ubiquinol and carnitine are my usual first starts, and then I'll kind of add on as needed.
Yeah. And a lot of that can come from food, right? Like if we get some chicken liver pate in there, that's your A covered. Vitamin C from fruits. Like we can definitely, I think we often think, oh crap. And you do these beautiful visuals often I've seen in the past where it's like, this is what those nutrients look like as food, to really help parents, focus on what could be on the plates to optimize.
Well, and I love that, because the best way to get your antioxidants is from the plant itself, right? Because if you're eating, that cliche, eat the rainbow, but, vitamin C extracted from, let's say, a cherry is not the same as eating the whole cherry or eating the pomegranate, because it's not just the vitamin C content. There's so many other antioxidants and phytonutrients that support not just mitochondrial recovery, but your microbiome. And there is a microbiome-mitochondria connection that needs to be supported, that can really help influence, your epigenetic profile. So, nature and its wisdom has all of these amazing nutrients found in plants that, we can get some benefits from the supplements, but they're not going to be nearly as much as what we can get from foods. And
yeah,
so for sure, we always want to try to get in food as medicine first.
And to link the mitochondrial function back to allergy, there a relationship there that's quite direct or no?
I mean, you know, Yes, in the sense that any stressor to the immune system is also going to stress the mitochondria. That'd be
Got it.
interesting to see, you know, how much. I mean, there is a mast cell mitochondria relationship, right?
And which is that a bit like chicken and the egg? Like which
it
ones?
Is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Because, you know, we often, I mean, for patients with chronic illnesses, we often see mitochondrial dysfunction and mast cell activation kind of hand in hand. And, you know, I think it's more whatever the initial trigger is likely triggering both. And now these are just sort of the kind of the canaries in a coal mine that, hey, your body needs to get back into balance. But, you know, as we, you know, because when we think about it, I mean, it's a very normal physiologic process for our mast cells to become activated, you know, when we're sick or, you know, when I mean, just as a normal and, you know, we need our mast cells. So it's not like, you know, mast cell activation. We want that sometimes, right? It's just, we don't want it perpetually. Right.
Yes. 100%.
And oxidative stress, you know, the creation of free radicals and oxidative stress, that's a very important part of detoxifying. So we need that to happen. It's just that when we don't have enough antioxidant reserve to mop up the oxidative stress, that's when we get into trouble. So all of these things, I mean, they're very normal physiologic and cellular processes. It's just that the way we're living nowadays in our modern world and just the environment that we're living in, you know, that we may not necessarily have control over, it's causing us more to swing into a dysregulated state.
On so many levels. Yeah, absolutely. And so when, you know, given we mentioned mold there and we've talked a lot about food allergies, is there a difference between how you would test for and treat for environmental allergic responses like dust mite? I mean, so many parents and families seem to struggle with dust mite than your food allergies?
You know, I think that I do think it is worthwhile if you're having any symptoms. Or the other interesting thing is sometimes what I'll see for kids who have environmental allergies, and, you know, right now, as we're speaking, we're in our springtime. And so, you know, seasonal allergies, springtime allergies are pretty rampant right now. And, you know, you have your classic, the sneezing, the itchy eyes, the scratchy throat and all of that. But some kids don't present with those classic quote allergy symptoms. What I'll sometimes see is, you know, kids who are presenting more with kind of mood or behavioral changes that in retrospect, we look back and we're like, oh, this happens like every October, or it seems like every spring something kicks up, right? So it's a seasonal pattern, or it could be GI symptoms. So now, well, why those two? Well, we have histamine receptors in every single cell in our body, including our brain, and histamine can act as a neurotransmitter. We have histamine type 4 receptors in our nervous system. And then why the GI? Well, you know, histamine receptors are lining our entire GI tract, mostly histamine type 2 receptors. And so, but, you know, when we have histamine floating around from environmental allergies, histamine doesn't just attach to, you know, selective histamine receptors. They'll attach wherever the receptors on the cells are to bind to them. And histamine type 1 receptors are going to be responsible for the itchy eyes, the sneezing, you know, the postnasal drip. Your histamine type 2 receptors are responsible for increased acid production in your stomach and reflux symptoms, or, you know, GI upset and diarrhea. And so I've had kids where it's really this kind of heartburn, you know, symptoms and the GI symptoms that seem to be more seasonal. And that makes sense. And so then, you know, I do like to check whether it's on scratch skin testing or blood testing for an environmental respiratory allergy panel. Now, I mean, here our lab's called a respiratory allergy panel, but it's kind of a misnomer. It's really just an environmental allergy panel, just to see, because sometimes I've had kids, like I had one kiddo who, you know, he had PANDAS, so pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric disorders associated with strep, and he would get this surge in, you know, tics and anxieties and kind of OCD thoughts. right around February, March. And it happened, you know, for it was like the second year it happened and we're kind of putting it together. And I'm like, okay, let's check an allergy panel. He had through the roof oak tree blood IgE, so immunoglobulin type E levels, not any respiratory symptoms, right? And he lived in a yard surrounded by beautiful oak trees, right? And so, yeah, so we're like, oh my gosh. And so we loaded him up with the mast cell stabilizers and the antihistamines and antioxidants, and his neuropsychiatric symptoms improved, right? And so the next year we knew we're just going to, before allergy season even starts, we're going to start these up so that we can, you know, prevent some of those non-classic allergy symptoms from happening.
And, you know, that's why the timelining piece that we were talking about earlier is so important. You know, look in retrospect, what was happening around that time? Did you move house? Did a season change? Did you have stressful exams to get into a special school? Like, was there anything that was out of the ordinary when you started to notice things for your kid? Because that's something that the parents are obviously going to be much better at, like, reflecting on and sitting down and thinking about.
But doing that timeline, you know, I think is so important, because a lot of times we don't necessarily connect the dots until we actually start talking about what's going on. And then either a light bulb goes off for you as a parent or the practitioner you're talking with, and you're like, oh my gosh, that maybe that's related. And then you pursue the testing, or you pursue some, you know, presumptive treatments. And I mean, just really taking that history is so important.
In a really broad sense.
Yes.
And you're a huge fan of homeopathics, so I kind of want to finish here, because I'd love to first ask you, as a pediatrician, there must have obviously been a point where these came onto your radar, because it's not pediatricians that are pediatricians right now. You didn't start as an integrative pediatrician.
Oh, no.
You know, right? And so yeah. What was the point
I wish.
At which, yeah, I know. Retrospect, there it is again, right? But what was the point at which you thought, these need a little bit of my investigation, and then to kind of come into how homeopathics might fit into looking at allergies and supporting allergic reactions?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, I actually did start in medical school wanting to learn more of an integrative approach, which is so unusual, right? I mean, this just, it was sort of, you know, I don't think there's any such thing as coincidence, right? Life happens in the way it's meant to. But when I was in, you know, at Stanford University as an undergraduate, you know, thinking about what do I want to do with my life? It wasn't medicine. It was actually law. And so, because I wanted to be a children's advocate, but it was my junior year, my third year, where I stumbled across this flyer on a big telephone pole. And it was a flyer for the American Holistic Medical Association. And I'm like, what is holistic medicine? This is in the late 80s, right? Just to date myself, right?
Well, that is totally groundbreaking. I love it.
So I'm like, what is this term? Because that was not a term being used at all, right? And in fact, the CDC had an office, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, at that time had an office of complementary and alternative medicine, right? Which, I mean, it shouldn't be alternative, but anyhow, I went to this conference as an undergrad and I was like, let me see what it's all about. And I mean, my mind was blown. I'm like, what, this thing called holistic medicine? This is amazing, right? We can actually, you know, heal people with food, and you know that there's power in you know, mindset. And so I heard from these docs who were just getting known at the time, like Andrew Weil and Deepak Chopra and Joan Borisenko. And I remember at the time I told my mom, I was like, you know, Mom, I think I want to be a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm. How did she go with that?
Well, you know, she was just like, what's that? Which was the common response, right? What's that? Because it wasn't as widely known then. Mm. And I mean, she never discouraged me, but she was just like, I don't know if people are going to really know what that is. Maybe you want to get your MD first. And so anyhow, that's how I ended up going to conventional medical school. But I was completely, you know, disillusioned with everything I was learning. Although I am glad in retrospect now, having gone through the conventional medical route, I feel like you know, there is a time and a place for things like antibiotics. And, you know, if my child has, you know, acute trauma, I want them to be seen by a trauma surgeon, or, you know, God forbid they develop some, you know, really life-threatening chronic illness. There may be some medications that are going to turn things around, right? At the same time, you know, we really do need to get to some of the root causes and underlying, you know, biochemical imbalances that got our kids there in the first place, and then, you know, learn how to kind of build back up that resilience from the ground up. So, but anyhow, so that was always my interest. And then when I was at UCSF doing my peds residency, I actually asked if I could use my elective time a month to go all around San Francisco and go to these different like alternative practitioners and learn how to use complementary and alternative medicine to treat and manage juvenile, so childhood arthritis, autoimmune arthritis. So yeah, so they let me. And I'm like, this is so cool. So I went into acupuncturist offices and chiropractor's offices. And, you know, I shadowed a homeopath who was also a medically trained doc, and, you know, just got to see all sorts of different ways of incorporating different modalities into a child's care. And so that's how I got into homeopathy. I'm like, this is really interesting. It doesn't make sense, right? It didn't make sense to me. But now, you know, seeing more and more of the data coming out, and what I remind people is that the definition of evidence-based medicine, which was really, you know, not even a term until I was in residency, right? Right. I mean, it was not a phrase. And now everyone now would say, oh, I want evidence-based medicine. Well, guess what? It was a term that was coined in the late 1990s, right? Not that new. And when I think it was Dr. Eisenberg first coined the phrase was meant to really be this triad. Okay. So yes, you rely on the current best existing scientific literature, knowing that there's a lot more literature research that hasn't been done, right? So the best existing scientific evidence with clinical evidence, right? Your clinical experience and your patient's preference, right? I mean, that your patient's cultural background and heritage all play into also what the best care is for them. So it's this triad of the art and the science and personalization of medicine that is truly evidence-based medicine.
Wow. Right? And that really plays into why doctors like take that Hippocratic oath, right? First do no harm, and let's have a look at the whole picture, and what is this person in front of me presenting with want? What do I know about what I've done in the past, and what do we know up to the minute? Like
that's right.
How we should practice.
We should. And that's where, you know, I think through the pandemic, you know, follow the science and evidence-based medicine, it became this mantra for just looking at what the research was. And guess what? Who funds the research? Who decides who gets researched and what gets researched, right? I mean, there's no such thing as unbiased research. So that's why we can only take, you know, the evidence, the research that we have, and then take that with a grain of salt and bring in the clinical experience of doctors and, you know, practitioners, integrative practitioners who have decades of experience and clinical successes. So anyhow, long story short, that's how I came to homeopathy. And I love homeopathy, especially for children, you know, infants, children. I mean, even for, you know, women who are nursing or maybe pregnant, when you use a homeopathic medicine from a reputable company, there really should be no interactions with any other medications that you're on. They're so, quote, infinitesimally diluted that there should be really no risk for harmful side effects. And I say reputable because you want to use a company that you know is really diluting the remedies in the most appropriate way. But that's why I think homeopathy gets such a, it's the least well understood, you know, integrative modality, because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just placebo. Oh, it's just a sugar pill. Well, first of all, we know that there's power in the placebo, right? Second, we also know, you know, from in vitro studies, like lab studies, you can't make things up in a petri dish, right? And also even animal veterinarian studies that and pediatric studies that there are some really significant, you know, positive outcomes with homeopathy, either compared with placebo or compared with conventional medicines. And for allergies in particular, there's this one homeopathic medicine called the homeopathic antihistamine. I guess there's two. There's one called Apis mellifica. So Apis mellifica, that in these ultra dilutions, there was a scientist, Dr. Benveniste, who took this homeopathic preparations of Apis mellifica and also homeopathically diluted histamine, so histaminum. And he surrounded these white blood cells called basophils, right, in these different ultra dilutions of histaminum or Apis mellifica. Now, these basophils were special basophils because they were already sensitized to, I believe it was dust mite, like an antigen, right? Where if they came into contact with the dust mite, they would release histamine, right? However, when these particular basophils were bathed, surrounded by these ultra dilutions of Apis mellifica or histaminum, and then exposed to dust mites, the degranulation was significantly inhibited. So what does that mean? That they didn't release histamine anymore.
Wow.
Right? Mm. And that was at multiple dilutions that were, for all intents and purposes, you would think, well, it's just water, right? But it's not, because now we can see it sort of this, you know, molecular level. I mean, this kind of electron microscopy level. I mean, you can see that there are difference in the water structure, right? It's like,
is it better described then as an energetic medicine, given structures are changing? Like, that's
Yeah. And, you know, and I would say it's interesting because, you know, when you speak about energetic medicine, a lot of times that gets kind of eye rolls, especially, you know, where I'm at in Silicon Valley.
Right. Yeah.
But now it's a whole different meaning, because we know on a quantum physics level, there are energetic changes that are happening at a cellular level, right? Even from, you know, what we're thinking, right? And so, you know, there is so much power to that. And I'm hoping that now, with more and more research at that kind of quantum physics energetic level, we will be able to see more clearly how these different homeopathic medicines work. Because I can tell you from my clinical experience, they work amazingly well. I mean, I had a kiddo in my waiting room who had started to develop hives all of a sudden out of the blue. And literally, as I was going back to get the Benadryl, the diphenhydramine, you know, in the back office, I gave the mom a tube of Apis mellifica. And I said, look, just give it to him like 3 pellets every 5 minutes. I'm going to be back. And, you know, I was rifling around trying to find where the Benadryl was, right? And by the time I came back, the hives were disappearing back up his body.
Wow.
I mean, in all of, you know, I mean, that was probably, you know, like 6-7 minutes, right? And so, and I have more stories like that if I didn't see with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe, right? But yet here I am, and I know that they work, which is why I recommend them.
Yeah. And such an easy, accessible, inexpensive thing to try. But nothing to lose, right?
Yeah. Nothing to lose. Right? Because if it doesn't work, you can always use your antihistamine, right? Your over-the-counter antihistamine, which, you know, we know that antihistamines, the medicines, right? Like, I don't know what they're called in Australia.
Oh, we've got like Telfast, Zyrtec.
Zyrtec is cetirizine, loratadine, which here is Claritin. We have, in some of the studies, they found that your over-the-counter antihistamines can disrupt your gut microbiome pretty much similarly to an antibiotic, right? And so so we just want to be mindful. I'm not saying never ever, but, you know, if we can use our natural, you know, therapies that don't have the same microbiome disrupting properties. And also, by the way, if you use something like quercetin, it has amazing phytonutrient and antioxidant properties. Why not?
Mm.
Right.
Mm. Yeah. And it really is like in the SOS bucket. Like, we do want to find out, which is everything we've talked about, why? And is there a mast cell inflexibility that we need to work on? Is there a gut microbiome situation that needs support to become less reactive. So I feel like we've covered pretty much all bases. So and it's not about shaming the SOS measures because they are so useful, and as we talked about with EpiPens, life saving. But we also want to deal with the reasons these things are happening in the first place and play a long game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining me to talk about allergies. I wanted to do this for ages, and I just know it's going to be so helpful to so many parents. And of course, they now have your book to, at least in America. We've got to wait a little while in Australia if you're listening to this live, but very, very excited to be able to share that with people too.
Oh, thank you, Alex. I always love chatting with you, and I cannot wait to come to Australia and give you and Seb a huge hug in person.
Yay. I hope you loved today's show as much as I loved bringing it to you. I want to remind you that if you are someone who craves a low-tox community that is judgment-free, full of empowerment, has health professionals and building health professionals that can support you, as well as me in there answering questions multiple times a week, I want to invite you to join the Low-Tox Club. For the price of less than a cup of coffee a month, you have an annual membership for $49 Australian, so it's about $30 US or Euro, that allows you to have a member masterclass every single month with a health professional or global expert from the podcast, where we have them to ourselves for an hour to ask questions and deep dive further. You have the beautiful supportive chat group. You have Q&As with me answering questions. We read books and talk about them, and a whole bunch more. You can head to lowtoxlife.com, hit the explore tab, and join the club is the very first option on that list. Of course, we have over 10 evergreen courses that you can jump into anytime, whether it's navigating everyday low tox swaps with our Go Low Tox signature course, whether you have kids and you're wanting to know how to best support them with our low tox kids course, whether you're planning a family and looking at a healthy low tox preconception journey, reducing inflammation, especially the chronic kind, with our Inflammation Ninja course, many, many other courses. You can again head to lowtoxlife.com, hit the courses tab, and you'll see all of the options, which includes a business course, my Low Tox Method program. A lot of people don't know, but I was doing a lot before starting Low Tox Life in 2009, and I was a business consultant across hospitality, health, retail, and cosmetics. I have been in business consulting for a very long time, so I absolutely adore helping people move into the low tox space or develop their low tox businesses. So that's a way I can support you. And then, of course, there's our wonderful social media communities at Low Tox Life on Instagram, and of course, the website with over 250 gluten-free recipes, blogs, downloadable PDFs to help you navigate wanting to get rid of synthetic fragrances in your school or office. I could go on. So head to lowtoxlife.com, see what takes your interest or fancy, and thank you so much for being a part of our podcast community. I love, love, love reading your reviews. I appreciate every follow and subscribe, and I want to just remind you to finish off that if there's anything you heard that you found interesting from a medical or scientific perspective, it is intended as education only. Please always chat to a health professional who knows you and your situation best. I'll see you next week. Bye.